Good evening, everybody. Let me welcome you all here this evening and extend a particular welcome to Professor Ulrich Beck. Professor Beck is not really a visitor to the LSE. He's a permanent part of the LSE. He's visited the LSE, I think, for the past 3 years now, and is spending a month this year. And his lectures, therefore, have a long while been a feature of the LSE intellectual community. Professor Beck is one of the four or five most famous sociologists in the world today. And he became famous above all for his first book, which is called Risk Society. And the theme of risk is one of the main themes of his writings. This was written in 1985. Very hard today, I think, to remember that people, especially in the social sciences, didn't really talk about risks very much in those days. Ulrich was, I think, the first major sociologist, along with Niklas Luhmann, to theorize the idea of risk and to argue that the notion of risk has become central to our lives. Why is this so? What is risk society? Well, why it is so is that we live in a society which has been, for better or for worse, largely released from the hold of tradition and custom, largely released from the hold of the past. It is the most future-oriented society of any society which has existed. In a society oriented towards the future, which has become a secular society where you no longer think that things are determined by the gods or by hazard or by luck, then the notion of risk becomes fundamental. The notion of risk is a way of engaging with an uncertain future. And in risk society, Ulrich showed that the notion of risk pervades all of our lives, from our most intimate lives, our experience of marriage and sexuality and the family, right the way through to the big problems of handling the risks produced, for example, by the advent of nuclear power or all sorts of technological interventions in the world, which have become so important in our day. Ulrich, then, along with his wife Elizabeth, wrote a book called The Normal Chaos of Love, which is a book about personal life and relationships, in which the same theme really is developed. That is, our lives are no longer fixed. Our identities are no longer fixed. We have to discover an identity. Our identities are much more fluid than they used to be. When you form relationships, you have to communicate with other people in an open fashion to get their trust. These things are no longer fixed by determined roles as they were in the past. This has transformed the nature of what marriage, for example, or the family indeed means for us today. Ulrich then went on to write a book, actually with me, about reflexive modernization. Reflexive modernization, one of the big themes, I would say, of his later writings. The idea of reflexive modernization is that modernization today always occurs in a self-conscious way. That is, modernization processes always occur now in the light of experience of the past, in the light of constant reflection about what modernity itself is. Modernity itself has become problematic. That problematic feature of modernity is integral to what modernization means. So it's no longer a simple, taken for granted process. It's endlessly problematic. In his lecture today, Ulrich is going to concentrate on one of his more recent works called World Risk Society, because the expansion of risks goes hand in hand with global interdependence. This is nowhere more obviously so in the light of recent events than the sorts of risks which we face from terrorist activities. Those risks, I believe, are far from over. Those dangers are far from over. I think it's almost undeniable that in the next 10 years minimum, we'll see some other major episode of global terrorist violence. It may happen very much sooner than that. So a whole new series of dangers and hazards have now become apparent to us. The theme of his lecture, the title of his lecture, World Society Revisited, as it says up there, the terrorist threat. So please give him a very good, rousing LSE welcome, Ulrich.
Thank you very much, Tony. A nice welcome to everybody. Good afternoon. It is, like always, a pleasure and an honor to talk and speak in this public space of the LSE, which has been created by Anthony Giddens. If you look for a place for more vital discussions, I think all over in the world you won't find any than the LSE. To me, it is really an exciting intellectual experience. Well, thank you for your introduction. I actually could just add a few remarks to them. Maybe I could even listen to what you said about risk society and the topics we have in common. You know, it's always difficult as a German professor to make a joke. Next time maybe I put a flag up here and raise the flag so you notice and can laugh when I'm joking. In my lecture I want to discuss three questions. First, what does world risk society mean? Second, what about the politics of world risk society, especially linked to the terrorist threat? And third, what are the methodological consequences of world risk society for the social sciences? So, to my first question, what does world risk society mean? What do events as different as Chernobyl, global warming, the mad cow disease, the debate upon the human genome, the Asian financial crisis, and September 11th terrorist attacks have in common? They signify different dimensions and dynamics of world risk society. Let me give you an example. Just a few years ago, the US Congress appointed a commission with the assignment of developing a system of symbols that could properly express the dangers posed by American nuclear waste disposal sites. The problem to be solved was, how can we communicate with the future about the dangers we have created? What concepts can we form and what symbols can we invent to convey a message to people living 10,000 years from now? The commission was composed of nuclear physicists, anthropologists, linguists, brain researchers, psychologists, biologists, sociologists, all those ists, artists, and others. The immediate question, the unavoidable question was, will there still be a United States of America in 10,000 years? As far as the government commission was concerned, the answer of this question was obvious, USA forever. The immediate question, but the key problem of how to conduct a conversation with the future turned out to be insolvable. The commission looked for precedents in the most ancient symbols of humankind. They studied Stonehenge and the pyramids. They studied the history of the diffusion of Homer's epics and the Bible. They had specialists explain to them the life circles of documents. But all of these only went back 2,000 or 3,000 years, never 10,000. Anthropologists recommended using the symbol of the skull and crossbones. But then an historian remembered that for alchemists, the skull and bones stood for resurrection. So psychologists conducted experiments with 3-year-olds to study their reaction. It turned out that if you stick a skull and crossbones on a bottle, children see it and immediately say poison. But if you put it on a poster on a wall, they scream pirates and they want to go exploring. Other scientists suggested plastering the disposal sites with many different warnings, in a great variety of languages. But the verdict of the linguists was uniformly the same. At best, the longest any of these languages would be understood was 2,000 years. What is remarkable about this commission is not only its research question, that is, how to communicate over 10,000 years, but the scientific precision with which it answered it. It is not possible. This exactly is what wordless society is all about. The speeding up of modernization had produced a gulf between the world of quantifiable risks in which we think and act and the world of non-quantifiable insecurities and uncertainties that we are creating. Past decisions about nuclear energy and present decisions about the use of gene technology, human genetics, nanotechnology, etc., are unleashing unpredictable, uncontrollable, and ultimately incommunicable consequences that might ultimately endanger all life on Earth. The concept of risk contains the concept of control. Pre-modern dangers were attributed to nature, gods, and demons. Risk is a modern concept. It presumes decision-making. As soon as we speak in terms of risk, we are talking about calculating the uncalculable, colonizing the future. In this sense, calculating risks is part of the master narrative of modernization. In Europe, this development culminates in the welfare state, which bases its legitimacy on the capacity to protect its citizens against dangers of all sorts. But what happens in wordless society is that we enter in a world of uncontrollable risks. And we don't even have a language to describe what we are facing. Uncontrollable risks, uncontrollable risk is a contradiction in term. And yet it is the only apt description for the second order unnational, human-made, manufactured uncertainties and hazards. It is easy to misunderstand the theory of wordless society as neo-Spenglerism, as a new theory about the decline of the Western world, or as an expression of typically German angst. Instead, I want to emphasize that the wordless society does not arise from the fact that everyday life has generally become more dangerous. It is not a matter of increase, but rather of debounding of new risks. This debounding is three-dimensional, spatial, temporal, and social. In the spatial dimension, we see ourselves confronted with risks which do not take nation-state boundaries or any other boundaries for that matter into account. Climate change, air pollution, and the ozone hole affected everyone, if not all in the same way. Similarly, in the temporal dimension, the long latency period of dangers, such as, for example, in the elimination of nuclear waste or the consequences of genetically manipulated food, escapes the prevailing procedures used when dealing with industrial dangers. Finally, in the social dimension, it is obvious how difficult it is to determine in a legally relevant manner who causes environmental pollution or financial crises, who is responsible. So the hidden priority in wordless society is how to feign control over the incontrollable, to feign control over the incontrollable in politics, law, science, technology, economy, and everyday life. We can differentiate between at least three different axes of conflict in wordless society. The first axis is that of ecological conflicts, which are by their very essence global. The second is global financial crisis, which in a first stage can be individualized and nationalized. And the third, which suddenly broke up, broke upon us on September 11th is the threat of global terror networks, which empower governments and states. When I say these risks are global, this should not be equated with the homogenization of the world, that is, that all regions and cultures are now equally affected by a uniform set of non-quantifiable, non-controllable risks in all areas, in areas like ecology, economy, and power. On the contrary, global risks are per se unequally distributed. They unfold in different ways in every concrete formation, mediated by different historical backgrounds, cultural and political patterns. In the so-called periphery, world risk society appears not as an endogenous process which can be fought by means of national decision making, but rather as an exogenous process which is propelled by decisions made in other countries, especially in the so-called center. People feel like the helpless hostages of these processes, and so far as corrections are virtually impossible at the national level. One area in which the difference is especially marked is in the experience of global financial crises, whereby entire regions on the periphery can be plunged and can be plunged into these depressions that citizens of the center do not even register at crisis. And yet, these conflicts still serve an integrative function, because they make it increasingly clear that global solutions must be found, and these cannot be found through war, but only through negotiation and contract. In the 1970s, the slogan was, "Make love, not war." When this is the slogan at the beginning, what is then the slogan of the beginning of the new year? It certainly rings more like "Make law, not war," as Mary Calder puts it so nicely a few weeks ago. Make law, not war. Ecological crises are only one axis of global risk conflict. Another lies in the risks of globalized financial markets. Crisis fluctuations in financial markets are as old as markets themselves. And it was already clear during the world crisis of 1929 that financial upheavals can have catastrophic consequences and that they can have huge political effects. The post-World War II institutions of Bretton Woods where global political solutions to global economic problems and their efficient functioning was an indispensable key to the rise of Western welfare state. But since the 17th, those institutions have been largely dismantled. We now have the paradoxical situation where global markets are more liberalized and globalized than ever, but global institutions set up to control them have seen their power drastically reduced. In this context, the possibility of a 1929 size catastrophe certainly cannot be excluded. Both ecological and financial risks have fundamental characteristics in common. They go beyond rational calculation and produce unpredictable turbulences. Moreover, they embody the struggle over the distribution of goods and bads, of positive and negative consequences of risky decisions, but above all, their effects are detailized. That is what makes them global risks. And that is what sets in motion the formation of global risk communities. But there are also important differences. One is that environmental and technological risks come from the outside. They have physical manifestations that then become socially relevant. Financial risks, on the other hand, originate in the heart of social structures, in its central medium. This then leads to several other differences. Financial risks are, for example, more individualized than ecological risks. A person and its next door neighbor can be affected in quite different ways. But this aspect does not mean that financial crises are potentially less risky. On the contrary, it increases their potential speed and reach. The economy is a central subsystem of modern society. And because all other subsystems depend on it, a failure of this type could be truly disastrous. So there are very compelling reasons to consider the world economy as another axis of world risk society. A further distinction can be made, however, between ecological and financial threats on the one side and the threat of global terrorist networks on the other. Ecological and financial conflicts both clearly result from the accumulation and distribution of bads that were tied up with the production of goods. They result from society's central decision, but as unintentional side effects of those decisions. Terrorist activities, on the other hand, is intentionally bad. It aims to produce the effects that the other crises produce unintentionally. Thus, the principle of intention replaces the principle of accident, especially in the field of economics. Much of the literature on risk in economics treats risk as a positive element within investment decision and risk taking, as a dynamic aspect to link to the essence of markets. But investing in the face of risk presupposes trust. Trust, in turn, is about the binding of time and space, because trust implies committing to a person, group, or institution over time. This prerequisite of active trust in the field of economics, as well in everyday life and democracy, is dissolving. The perception of terrorist threats replaces active trust with active mistrust. It therefore undermines the trust in fellow citizens, foreigners, and governments all over the world. Since the dissolution of trust multiplies risks, the terrorist threat triggers a self-multiplication of risks by debounding of risk perceptions and fantasies. This, of course, has many implications. For example, it contradicts the image of the Homo economicus as an autarkic human being and risk taker. One of the consequences thereof is the principle of private insurance is partly being replaced by the principle of state insurance. In other words, in the terrorist risk society, the world of individual risk is being challenged by a world of systemic risk, which contradicts the logic of economic risk calculation. Simultaneously, this opens up a new question and potential conflicts, namely how to negotiate and distribute the costs of terrorist threats and catastrophes between businesses, insurance companies, and states. Therefore, it becomes crucial to clearly distinguish between, on the one hand, the conventional enemy image between conflicting states, and on the other hand, the transnational terrorist enemy, which are individuals or groups, but first of all, not states. The main question is who defines the identity of transnational terrorists? Neither judges nor international courts, but powerful governments and states. They empower themselves by defining who is their terrorist enemy, their bin Laden. The fundamental distinctions between war and peace, attack and self-defense, collapse. Terrorist enemy images are detailized, denationalized, and flexible state constructions that legitimize the global intervention of military powers as self-defense. President Bush painted a frightening picture of 10,000 of Al-Qaeda-trained terrorists in at least a dozen countries. He uses the most expensive interpretation: they are to be destroyed. Bush's alarmism has a paradox effect. It gives Islamic terrorists what they want most: recognition of their power. Bush had encouraged the terrorists to believe that the United States really can be badly hurt by terrorist actions like these. So there's a hidden mutual enforcement between Bush's empowerment and the empowerment of terrorists. Here's another difference. The pluralization of experts and experts' rationalities, which characterizes ecological and financial risks, is replaced by the simplification of enemy images constructed by governments and intelligence agencies without and beyond public discourse and democratic participation. So there are huge differences between the external risk of ecological conflicts, the internal risks of financial conflicts, and the intentional terrorist threats. To summarize those differences, bad intentions replaces accident. Active trust changes into active mistrust. The context of individual risk is replaced by the context of systemic risk. Private insurance is partly replaced by state insurance. The definition power of experts has been replaced by the definition power of states and intelligence agencies. And the pluralization of expert rationalities has turned into the simplification of enemy images. Thus, the terrorist threat had made everyone into a disaster movie scriptwriter, now condemned to image the effect of a homemade atomic bomb assembled with the help of gene or nanotechnology and so on. Second question, what about the politics of world risk society? So there's a sinister perspective for the world after September 11th. It is that uncontrollable risk is now irredeemable and deeply engineered into all processes that sustain life in advanced societies. Pessimism then seems to be the only rational stance. But this is a one-sided and therefore truly misguided view. People have often asked, what could unite the world? And the answer sometimes given is an attack from Mars. In a sense, that was just what happened on September 11th, an attack from our inner Mars. It worked as predicted. For a few weeks at least, the varying camps and nations of the world united against the common foe of global terrorism. I would like to suggest 5 lessons that can be drawn from this. The first lesson: in an age where trust and faith in God, class, nation, and government have largely disappeared, humanity's common fear has proved as last resource for making new bonds. In his book, The Public and Its Problems, written 1927, John Dewey argues that it is not the decision, but its consequences and risks that create a public in the post-traditional world. The perceived risk of global terrorism has had exactly the opposite effect than that which was intended by the terrorists. It has pushed us into a new phase of globalization, the globalization of politics, the muddling of states into transnational cooperative networks. Once more, the rule has been confirmed that resistance to globalization only accelerates it. Anti-globalization activists operate on the basis of global rights, global markets, and global networks. They both think and act in global terms, and use them to awaken global awareness and global public. So the term anti-globalization movement is misleading. Many fight for another globalization, for an alternative globalization, global justice, rather than anti-globalization. Of course, there's a hidden alliance between Western and non-Western nihilistic movements as well. This is the second lesson on the terrorist attack. National security is no longer national security. Alliances are nothing new, but the difference is its purpose to preserve internal and not external security. All the distinctions that make up our standard picture of the modern state, the borders that divide domestic from international, the police from military, crime from war, and war from peace, have been overthrown. It were precisely those distinctions that defined the nation state. In the aftermath of the terrorist attack, the state is back. And for the oldest Hobbesian reason, the provision of security. Around the world, we see governments become more powerful. But at the same time, the two most dominant ideas about the state, the idea of the national state and the idea of the neoliberal state, have both lost their reality and their necessity. Here's the third lesson. September 11 exposed neoliberalism's shortcoming as a solution to the global risks. The terrorist attack on America were the Chernobyl of globalization. Just as the Russian disaster undermined our faith in nuclear energy, so September 11 exposed the false promise of neoliberalism. The privatization of aviation security in the US provides just one example, but a highly symbolic one. It was long suspected that the US could be a possible target for terrorist attacks. But aviation security was privatized and entrusted to highly flexible part-time workers who were paid even less than employees in fast food restaurants. It is America's neoliberal political philosophy and self-image that creates its vulnerability. The horrible pictures of New York contain this message. A state, a country, can neoliberalize itself to death. Surprisingly, this has been recognized by the US itself. Aviation security has been transformed into a federal state service. This demonstrates, in time of global risk, neoliberalism has no solution to offer. Fundamental truths that were pushed aside turned to the fore. Without taxation, there can be no state. Without public sphere, democracy, and civil society, there can be no legitimacy. And without legitimacy, no security. From this premises, it follows that without legitimate forms for settling national and global conflicts, there will be no world economy in any form whatsoever. We need to combine economic integration with cosmopolitan politics. Human dignity, cultural identity, and otherness must be taken more seriously in the future. Since September 11th, the gulf between the world of those who profit from globalization and the world of those who feel threatened by it has been closed. Helping those who have been excluded is no longer a humanitarian task. It is the West's own interest, the key to security. The West can no longer ignore black holes of collapsed states and situations of despair. Fourth lesson. I think it is necessary to distinguish clearly between, on the one hand, not national but global unilateralism. Global unilateralism is a term Solana used. Global unilateralism meaning the politics of a new American empire, the Pax Americana, and on the other hand, two ideals of multilateralism, namely surveillance states and cosmopolitan states. Before and after September 11th, US foreign policy changed rapidly from national unilateralism to global unilateralism. The idea of a new world order has taken shape in Washington think tanks, and the US is supposed to both make and enforce its laws. The historian Paul Kennedy believes that the new American empire will be even more powerful than the classical imperial powers like Rome and Britain. This is America's problem today. Real cooperation will require the Bush administration to swallow a word, that even September 11 didn't quite force down, multilateralism. But on the other hand, we have to distinguish between two forms of transnational cooperation as well, surveillance states and cosmopolitan states. Surveillance states threaten to use the new power of cooperation to build themselves into fortress states, in which security and military concerns will loom and will loom large and freedom and democracy will shrink. From this, a frightening mixture of ideology and politics might arise. Globalization winners could get neoliberalism, and globalization losers could get the other side of the coin, a heightening fear of foreigners born out of the appreciation of terrorism and bristling with the poison of racism. This is my fifth lesson. If the world is to survive this century, it must find a way to civilize world-risk society. A new big idea is wanted. I suggest the idea of a cosmopolitan state founded upon the recognition of the otherness of the other. National states present a threat to the inner complexity, multiple loyalties, the social flows and fluids of risk and people that world-risk society has caused across national borders. Conversely, nation states cannot but see such a fuzzing of borders as a threat to their existence. Cosmopolitan states, by contrast, emphasize the necessity of solidarity with foreigners, both inside and outside the national borders. They do this by connecting self-determination with the responsible for the national and non-national others. Cosmopolitan states can be founded on the principle of the national indifference of states. This is a concept similar to the way in which during the 16th century the Peace of Westphalia ended the religious civil war through the separation of church and state. In a similar manner, the separation of state and nation could be the solution to some problems of the 21st century. Just as a religious state finally made possible the peaceful coexistence of multiple religions side by side, the cosmopolitan state could provide the conditions for multiple national and religious identities to coexist through the principle of constitutional tolerance. We should seize this opportunity to reconceive the European political project as an experiment in the building of cosmopolitan states. And we should envision a cosmopolitan Europe whose political force would emerge directly not only out of the worldwide struggle against terrorism, ecological and financial risks, but also out of both the affirmation and taming of European national complexity. So my third and final questions: what are the methodological consequences of world-risk society? And maybe those who fall asleep already can just sleep deeper now, listening to the methodological consequences. The theory of world-risk society questions the fundamental premises of social science, that is, the methodological nationalism. Methodological nationalism equates societies with nation-state societies. and sees states and their governments as the cornerstone of social science analysis. A sharp distinction should be made between methodological nationalism on the one hand and normative nationalism on the other. The former is linked to the social science observer perspective, whereas the latter refers to the perspectives of political actors. In a normative sense, nationalism means that every nation has the right to determine itself within the frame of its cultural distinctiveness. Methodological nationalism assumes this normative claim as a socio-ontological given and simultaneously links it with the most important conflict and organization orientations of society and politics. In a nation-state outlook on society and politics, law and justice, it is a nation-state outlook on society and politics, law, justice and history, which governs the imagination of the social science. It therefore also structures empirical research in, for example, the choice of statistical indicators, which are almost always exclusively national. A refutation of methodological nationalism from a strictly empirical viewpoint is therefore difficult, because many statistical categories and investigations are based upon it. The critique of methodological nationalism should not be mistaken for the thesis of the end of the nation state. Just as when criticizing methodological individualism, one does not necessarily promote the end of the individual. Nation state, of course, will continue or will be transformed into transnational states. At any rate, the decisive point is that national organization as a structure and principle of societal and political action can no longer serve as a premise for social science observers' perspective. Thus, it is necessary to elaborate a cosmopolitan social and political science. Cosmopolitan social science entails a systematic breaking up of reciprocal confirmation process through which the national perspective of politics, society, as well as the methodological nationalism approve and strengthen each other in the definition of reality. This paradigmatic reconstruction of social science from a national to a cosmopolitan perspective can be understood and explained as a positive problem shift, as Imre Lakatos, LSE philosopher as well, named it. That is, in the sense of broadening the horizons for social science research. When politics and society are debounded, the distinctions between inside and outside, domestic and foreign politics, we and the others become obsolete and have to be redefined, and the mixture of them have to be reanalyzed in special fields of social and political analysis. Therefore, it becomes necessary to systematically raise the question of a paradigmatic change, which is characterized by the opposition of methodological nationalism and methodological cosmopolitanism. The horizon opened up by this distinction reveals a new configuration of the world. Previously, the national cosmos could be decomposed into clear distinctions between inside and outside. Between the two, the nation-state order was established. In the inner space, the central themes of work, politics, law, social inequality, justice, cultural identity were negotiated against the background of the nation and its others. Thus, a new mapping of space and time is necessary, new coordinates for the social and political, coordinates which have to be theoretically and empirically researched and elaborated. And this is one of the subjects, a large center of research in Munich, which I'm to some extent be which I'm leading, is specialized on how to reorganize social research on a non-national but cosmopolitan frame of reference in all those different fields. I'm just mentioning this because, you know, there is some more material arguments behind this than in this abstract version I'm giving you here. Thus, world-rich society makes heavily demands on social science. Social science must be re-established as transnational science of the reality of denationalization, transnationalization, and re-ethnification in a global age. This entails that the concept of modern society must be re-examined. Household, family, class, democracy, power, state, public, justice, history must be released from the fetters of methodological nationalism, must be reconceptualized and empirically established within a framework of cosmopolitan social science, which remains to be developed. So this is quite a list of understatements to be handled. I cannot think of any better context than the LSE, where these understatements could be successfully managed. Thank you for your attention.
We've got about 20 minutes or so for questions and answers, so I'll probably leave Ulrich to pick his interrogators. There should be roving mics going around the room somewhere.
How many years do you think the cosmopolitan state you are talking about will come about? Coming to being.
Beg your pardon, I didn't understand the question.
How many years do you think it will take for the cosmopolitan state you're talking about to coming to being?
Well, this is one of those tricky questions, maybe even a risky one. Nobody can answer these questions realistically. But I think there's some chances in some areas of the world, and even more chances than they are being perceived and realized in the political sphere. I think, for example, that the idea of Europe does have a lot of problems because we think of Europe mostly as a big, large nation state, which overthrows and dissolves all other nations. In the moment, if we conceive Europe as a concept which affirms the different national complexities and makes this as the basic idea of a cosmopolitan Europe, it could be even easier to be realized if this idea is being thought through and politically organized. But on the other side, we still, to take this example and pick up your questions, it is hardly very difficult to understand that Europe on the one side has a common financial basis now, the euro, but there has never been a European decision on the euro. There has only been nation state decisions on the euro. There had not even been a common European discussion on this subject as well. And to take another example, we do have somehow integrated, economically integrated European non-state so far, but we don't have any parties on the national level which pick up the European issue. You could think of cosmopolitan party organizations inside of all the nation states picking up the European project inside of national political sphere. And they could even, if they have only, let's say, 5% or 7% in all different nation state, it could have quite an impact on the political discussions, because there is an alternative for the organization of political parties, and this would be a transnational political organization inside of Europe, and such produce some political identity inside of Europe. So to some extent, I even agree with you, but I would think there's a European possibility to create more of this idea of a cosmopolitan state than it is so far realized. I don't know.
There's a microphone coming around. Maybe you'd speak up, because it's not too easy to hear from down here.
You suggested that fear is the last resource for establishing common bonds between people. But you went on to say that, to suggest that there should be a separation of the state from the nation, and suggest that instead that the state could be based on constitutional tolerance. Is that a polite way of saying that the state is based on fear, or do you think that there can be something more positive meant by constitutional tolerance?
Again, a very sophisticated question. But I don't think those two arguments exclude each other. You know, we do have a lot of ideas and models, political ideas and models. But the main question still is how those models find a political force, a cultural and political force to be realized. And my argument in relation to global risks and dangers, as I said, is very ambivalent. On the one side, normally we have the idea that those threats dissolve cultural communities. But I want to point at the opposite direction, that threats do have a very important impact on producing new kind of risk communities. People are being combined in a way which they don't want to be combined. They have to communicate, even if they don't want to communicate, beyond borders, between different expert roles, public groups, managers, and so on. They're being connected in a way nobody really wants to be connected. And it even as it is very interesting if you want to have this perspective in mind, to look at the history of social theory. And as I said, this idea from Dewey, that it is not the decision itself which creates political communities, but the consequences of decisions which are being discussed publicly. This creates a new form of community and imposed traditional society and context. I think this is a very important idea which just fits this purpose. I don't want to be misunderstood. There's this kind of integration through risk communities is very ambivalent. On the one side, it's a conflict, it's a diversion of perspectives, it's a different rationalities, but they are forced together in an interesting way. They have to communicate and they have to react to each other. And this is a political force which even happened, you know, after September 11th. For the first time, politicians all over the world realized that they can change political relationship. I sometimes have the feeling that some prime ministers got even high, you know, high. They had some alcohol or something, just by flying around and trying to change the world. I'm not mentioning him. They just got the feeling that they could change the world. Inside of nation state, they cannot do much. But outside in the transnational sphere, this global risk is opening up structures which can be redefined. And this is the one side argument. The other side argument is that cosmopolitan states could be one element of a solution to those transnational problems I was discussing about.
What is the difference between Tony Blair and God? God is everywhere in the world. Tony Blair is everywhere in the world except in the UK. Well, there's a question from down there. Don't tell anyone I said that. I hope this is not going on Fathom.
Well,
I don't know.
You could shout maybe, but the people at the top can't hear unless you get the mic. It's worse.
That's fine. Just a minute. Okay. No, it's one of the mic back there. Oh, I don't know.
The mic's coming back to you.
Maybe you'd start and then afterwards. So we don't
yes, can I start? Asked a question, Professor Beck, thank you for your talk. I'll just run quickly through the questions. There are four of them. What does individuality mean today in 2002, and what will it mean in 10 years? With regard to expansionism, active... What does individuality mean today in 2002, and what will individuality mean in 10 years? The second question is, with regard to expansionism, active and non-active, individual and group participation, automation, how do you envisage the human place in the world and in the universe in the future? Third question.
Now we get the question.
Is
yeah.
How do you see cosmopolitanism in practice, in everyday life, in the streets? And finally, last one, do you see women ruling the world?
Do you want to pass the mic down towards the
Do you want me to answer in 1 minute or in the rest of the time left? Well, individualization is one of my important topics, which is not part of the lecture today. But I think on the one hand, globalization and on the other hand, individualization are connected to each other. Both are forms of detraditionalization of life forms. So individualization is actually, if you picture it as a process where individuals can autonomously decide and autonomously react, it's a completely wrong picture, it's a completely false picture. Because this individualization is the highest degree of social and political organization. And in order to make an individual life and organize an individual life, you have to be highly social sensitive in order to just organize your individual life in all areas, in families or in politics and so on. And we find that those individuals who are highly individualized at the same time do have commitments which are not the commitment maybe of the neighbor and so of the neighborhood and then the next person, but global commitments or transnational commitments which are detailized and so on. So we need a different frame of reference even to find out what this individualization means. I don't know if I answered your question. But
what's the difference between Tony Blair and God? God doesn't think he's Tony Blair.
Yeah, I'm not going to answer this question.
Okay. Please allow me to admire your analysis because you picked up some notions which we see and read about in everyday life, and you rearranged them within a logical vision, which led to a very good conclusion. The question I'd like to ask you is related to your idea of the cosmopolitan state and the new shape of a new world order, because now we live in an inequitable world, and the leader of the new world order, the United States, is opposing the conventions on environment. And even when they are dealing with the threat of terrorism right now, they bring about criticism against them in the treatment of people. How do we lead to a new world in which we can avoid such misgivings and create more equitable world?
Well, again, one of those fantastic questions. And exactly, this is the question where I think nobody has a... I don't have a rational answer, because if you even look more in detail, you have to say, the main argument is the Kant argument. You have to persuade, you have to argue, you have to try to convince people. And there, of course, are some movements in this direction. For example, even if this is maybe not politically correct, but the force of the market, the force of capital, could become or could be structured as a cosmopolitan force. It is not right now, but it could be like it has been in the national phase, when the nation state and the national modernity was created. But on the other side, as you say, in order to enforce a new order, you have to use power, and power is still nationalized, and there's one huge military power. There are other military powers as well. But how to convince a military power about using the international court system and agreeing to ecological treaties and so on is quite difficult, as we see. Maybe there are some who believe that this is possible, but I don't have a patent how to do it myself.
Can I ask you to speak up again so everyone in the room can hear the question?
Engineers often tell you that the best way to minimize the risk is to distribute the weight along the whole of the structure. And as a sociologist, would you adopt the analogy and say that in order to minimize international risk, especially in the sense of violence, you'd have to perhaps challenge the American hegemony? It's a form of distribution, I don't know. You distribute the weight throughout the structure, thereby you minimize the risk of the whole structure collapsing and instability within the structure. And I think the fact that America is so powerful concentrates influence in America without any heed to the concerns of the rest of the world. And I think that relates to your idea of cosmopolitanism, because cosmopolitanism means that you integrate your debate with everybody's ideas included, and American power, to some extent, detracts from that.
But I think this is one way perspective again. My perspective of world risk society is more about ambivalence, to recognize the insecurities and the dilemmas of political action and thought. And I think you have to realize that there are terrorist threats which are not produced by America, which are produced by many reasons. It's very difficult to find out what really are those causes of terrorist activities. And they are not related, for example, or not easily to relate to poorness. They are related to some extent, as we know, to religious fundamentalism. And they're even rooted inside of Western cultures as well. There's not only an Islamic terrorist threat, but it is inside of Western countries as well. So I think you cannot just say that the American hegemony is the main cause for all the problems. This would be too easy. And on the other side, you even, as you can see, even if you don't like this interpretation, the intervention in Afghanistan, even if you don't agree with it, has produced facts which are very agreeable, because this country does have a new chance. And it is like, to pick up an example which is very close to me, it's like a new Germany. It's like a Germany which could be, which could try to organize itself in a democratic way. So this is actually the first result of this intervention. I'm just saying this because you have to be very careful. There are lots of ambivalences and dilemmas, and just to put it one way, I think it's too easy.
Yeah, but can I ask a question, because some don't normally do that, but I think the questioner might have been implying that the world actually after September 11 looks very different from the one you're portraying, because what you have in the case of the US is a reassertion of unilateralism. That's the main consequence of the war in Afghanistan, I think, for the current American regime. You've got a massive build-up of American power with tremendous investment in the military that you've seen announced yesterday or the day before by President Bush. You've got the kind of abrogation of the human rights discourse. Michael Ignatieff just wrote this interesting article called The End of Human Rights, in which he says that the Americans now given up on human rights in China, human rights in Chernobyl, Chechnya, and all the areas of the world where previously there was American pressure, albeit somewhat hypocritical, to recognize those rights. So I thought the question was implying, couldn't you say that the world looks almost completely opposite of what you're saying, no cosmopolitan nation, instead a sort of massive reassertion of American hegemony backed by much greater military power than the US has even deployed previously, which in the future will be used to police the world to American interests, essentially?
Well, my main question, listening to your argument, is why?
It's not an argument.
No, that's your question whatsoever. it wasn't a joke, you know.
Make another Tony Blair joke. You're not,
No, I mostly agree with all you said. My lecture tried to show how the terrorist threat does open up enormous political space for a military reinvention of state and in a global sphere, and rejects quite a few aspects of civil society and ecological threats, which formerly had the main attention. But I think you have to make, maybe this is a difference, and maybe this was an ambivalence or not a clear statement in my lecture, you have to make a difference between cosmopolitanism as an idea and a political philosophy, which has to be explained on the one hand, and the reality of globalization and globalization from within, and or you could even say cosmopolitization from within. And I think on the one hand, you even find in this picture you were painting, you can find the opposite tendencies as well. It is right that the United States build up those new military power, but at the same time, it is not national unilateralism anymore, but global unilateralism, which is a contradiction in term again. They to some extent learn that their internal security depends on a transnational alliance. You know, they need to intervene, for example, even in Hamburg, maybe London or whatsoever, in order to solve their internal security problems. I think for the first time, really, you could say that in America, globalization is becoming an internal problem for politics, even if it is not cosmopolitization, even if it is not cosmopolitization. So I think you have to be a bit more sophisticated in order to see the dialectic of those processes. In a German word which I cannot translate, so nobody understands me, you could say what is happening is die List der Vernunft. Die List der Vernunft. It's hard to. Yes, you heard that before. Hegel said it.
The question right at the back there. There's still quite a few questions, so if you don't mind going on for a little while, we'll...
Yeah, okay.
Do you know how the insurance bill for the World Trade Center has been dealt with? And I just, another thing is, how do you define state insurance? What do you mean by state insurance when you're talking about insurance? So just those two.
Well, this is one of those questions which you really have to go into details. When I have been asked what is actually the difference between the normal risk which we are able to control and to calculate, and the world risk society or risk society I'm talking about, I found out that one of the main issues is private insurance. You know, this is very interesting because private insurance is the economic rationality of calculation as a basis for the calculation the consequences of industrial processes and decisions. And so when I've been asked what is actually the difference between calculable and uncalculable risk, I said, look at the pragmatic criterion and principle of private insurance. If they are not private insured, then there's something interesting happening. And if you look at it in an empirical way, you find out that quite a few of those controversial new technologies and industries are not private insured. Of course, atomic energy is not private insured, but state insured. But as you, at the discussion after the September 11th came up, you know, in many different fields, economic fields, now the question is raised, are we responsible, do we as insurance companies or as companies whatsoever, are responsible for the consequences and the cost which are produced by terrorist attacks? And who actually has to insure, has to pay for these dangers? And now there's a discussion in public and more than in public, even between governments and in all kind of institutions, where the states are responsible and have to pay in what amount in relation to private insurance. So this is in a process of negotiation now, very important process of negotiation, because it contradicts the neoliberal perspective and it contradicts even, the whole picture economic theorists are painting of risk taking and its problems. And I think to just add one more argument, I think this makes it so difficult for economic experts to accept the big differences which are happening after September 11th.
Can you take the mic? No, the mic's there.
Oh, thank you very much. I've got a question. It's, I think, relating to the theme. One of the reasons it could be that you have this terrorism in the West is that what is happening now, the industrial societies in Europe are actually, I think, increasingly worried about, we usually read about expanding populations, they're decreasing in terms of their birth rates. The populations, having reached a certain level, are going down, whereas the world population is growing, but I think it's mainly in Asia and Africa and the Middle East that the populations are tremendously increasing. And there's a growing need, though you have on the right moves against immigration, there's an economic need for people, more than ever before, skilled people. Like in Germany, they've given special dispensation for people from Bangalore, training computer technology, to work in Germany because there's not enough Germans. And I think this is an underlying demographic tendency that almost all Western, and Japan also worries about this, industrial society, are beginning to worry about not sufficient people being born. Whereas it's from areas of the world where there's still tremendous political tensions, where the population is increasing. Has this anything to do with this question of growing terrorism? I'd be interested in your view.
Well, I do agree with your basic argument. It's, of course, Germany is maybe the outstanding example for it, that the population is going down, people are getting older, the aged society is coming up with all its perspectives. And of course, in order to produce wealth, we need immigration in a large scale. It even in Germany has been argued that in 50 years from now, only 40% of the needed workers are going to be recruited from inside. Maybe there so many people have to be from outside and have to be foreigners. So there's a congruence between globalization on the one hand and policy for opening up borders on the other side. I cannot see that this tendency does have a direct causal relationship to the terrorist threat. It does have an implication in one dimension. You know, we have so many problems in even naming what is happening. And all the concepts we are using, like state, war, peace, crime, or terrorism, don't fit anymore. And we are confronted with what I tried to name transnational terrorist networks. And of course, through immigration, the possibility of transnational networks is increasing, and it's very difficult to control. And if you look at what kind of controls are being established, you find out that they are mostly pointed at those who live inside of a society, who are citizens already, and not those who are transnational connected. So there might be a relationship.
Thank you.
Let's just take two more questions. That'll take us up to 8 o'clock, more or less. So, Ulrich, I'll let you pick your last two questions.
It's faded. Maybe you on the back. Yes.
Yeah, I'd just like to explain a bit more how you think common fear can form social bonds. Because it seems to me that that could be the case if it was a kind of specific fear or awareness of a specific definable threat. But the kind of awareness of risk that you're talking about seems to be much more generalized, undefinable, a collapsing of boundaries between inside and outside. Isn't the tendency, therefore, to always break down any associations that, that form? Because ultimately, you end up seeing the other person as a source of risk.
I'm not quite sure if I really understood your question. It's again the question: how, what does risk communities really mean? How do risks produce and create bonds? And of course, I think it's very important to recognize first of all that this is a completely different question that it is normally discussed in the theory of social and political science, where they do have in mind that there's a value integration and integration based on interaction in a state-organized, territorialized society or community like a city and so on and so on. And I think it's important to realize that this is a different kind of integration, but not an old integration, because risks interpretation do produce, on the one side, fear, which I would say Angst in the German version, which I would say disintegrates all kind of interaction and bond creation, because it enforces panics and irrationality and all kind of violent reactions maybe to this kind of angst. But I would differentiate between this angst and fear, or Furcht as we say in German, which is more reflexive and which does have a sociological perspective, because this kind of fear is a reflexive process of globalization to some extent. We have this term in the discussion of globalization. We have the term of globality. Globality is the term has been coined by Martin Orbrow and Robertson, and they mean by globality not only. They mean by globality always is a reflexive process, an everyday process of the reflection and interdependence of on a global level, like the pictures of September 11th showed. Everybody was affected in its everyday life, and it's a kind of reflection which is going on. This kind of reflection produces conflicts, produces different interpretation, but at the same time, on a form, on an everyday level, which integrates global ways of life into your own horizon and experimental space. So this is what I mean by risk communities to some extent. This reflexivity of a global interconnectedness, even on an everyday life, which produces something like, you could say, a new common fate, an experience of a new common fate, which could be the basis for political action and community construction. Let's pick up one more question up there. Maybe this one back there.
I want to ask a rather critical question, actually. I cannot really share your optimism about the cosmopolitan state, or that the cosmopolitan state will come about in the nearer future, if you consider that even before the 11th of September, in the whole of Europe, there is an increased rise of nationalism in many of the countries. I mean, many nationalistic parties like the Freedom Party in Austria, or also the parts of other parties in Germany, or the Lega Nord of Italy. gave a new sense of identity to people in the country, which was probably not the intellectual elite of the country, which now tries to implant this cosmopolitan or neoliberalistic ideas, but were probably more the people who are concerned of, we want to have something again next to us, which gives us security, rather than some kind of ideal cosmopolitan state. And I also wonder, how can you really, in a certain way, justify and say to them, well, the cosmopolitan state is the real answer to the question, if they say, well, nationalism will probably work as well, we just need to deplore certain international institutions like probably the IMF or some other institutions, which at the moment causes a lot of troubles. So I wonder what kind of justification you can give to the people on the street who at the moment rather want to go to nationalistic ideas rather than to utopian or idealistic cosmopolitan ideas.
Well, first of all, it's one of the worst accusations an intellectual can face, that he is an optimistic, you know. If you are optimistic, you are really, you're already in a bad position. But I talk about, you have to keep in mind that I talk about world with society, as you know, this is actually what I'm mainly talking about. And I'm, on the other side, maybe I'm the worst pessimist you can find. But I think those distinctions between pessimism and optimism don't work really very good. But I try to answer your question in details. I agree. The cosmopolitan state is not the main realistic perspective, which we, if we look realistically at the scenario in Europe or all over the world. And there are many different scenarios coming up. And you're quite right. If you look at Eastern Europe, even the nation state could be an utopia. It is maybe more an ethnic state, a state which is only based on an ethnic identity, which doesn't include the other but excludes it, just throw them out. Maybe this is one of the main perspectives in many other areas of the world. So it is not... Again, as I tried to do in my lecture and in my writings, you have to distinguish between the possibility and the realistic chances of a development and different views, different perspectives. And on the other side, I don't find it very difficult to draw a picture of absolute pessimism. I think this is very easy. To be pessimistic is very easy. It's not difficult. It's much more challenging, and it's necessary that we do have one or two or maybe three or whatsoever perspectives which go beyond. If we don't have those perspectives, they don't have any chance at all. And I think we are at the same time, even if you can't see how all those problems enforce even more negative perspectives, there are lots of possibilities coming up. And I don't see a cosmopolitan Europe be created or possible without the perspective of a cosmopolitan state. And I think the role of intellectuals is getting very important in this situation. And intellectuals don't only have the necessity to describe all the bad things which are happening, but at the same time have to create some ideas of a transformation which is worth fighting for. I think this is an important role of even of the social sciences in the age of transition we are in. So this is why I'm a pessimistic optimist or an optimistic pessimist talking about a cosmopolitan state.
Can I just apologize to all those people who wanted to ask questions? Just before we finish, can I just mention one or two events happening over the next week or two in case anyone wants to go to them? Tomorrow the Finnish Prime Minister is coming to lecture here. I can't remember the time of day, but it's sometime around early afternoon. I can't remember the place either, but it's on the website. Finland is often thought to be one of the most interesting countries of Europe, the most socially advanced and also until recently anyway, economically prosperous. Anyone who wants to come, I think, is invited to that. Then Helen Clark, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, is coming next week. That also should be interesting because talking about neoliberalism, New Zealand was the place, really, which tried the most radical neoliberal experiment of all, albeit led by primarily by a Labour government. You could also check when that's happening on the website. And the Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, is coming, I think, the week after that or towards the end of the month. I'm not sure how easy it will be to get into that, but you can see posters on the walls which will give you at least some indication of how you might apply for tickets. I'm not quite sure how they're going to organize that. So please come to some of these events. In the meantime, thanks to everyone for staying, and please give Ulrika a good round of applause.